This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello, welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Carol Van Dam, and here's what's coming up.
If you look at all of these countries that are in the Congo Basin area in particular, rich biodiversity, carbon sink, the largest carbon sink in the world, they get nothing for that.
That's African Development Bank President Akinwumi Adesinema, a push to revalue African countries with rich natural resources, he says. Also, Russia has suspended its participation in the Black Sea Grain Initiative, which is likely to hit Africa hard. And Tunisia and the EU have signed a deal aimed at combating human traffickers and tightening borders. All this and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. Russia today suspended its participation in the Black Sea Grain Initiative, which allowed Ukrainian grain to flow to Africa, Asia, and the Middle East, unimpeded by Russia's war against Ukraine. At a UN Security Council stakeout in New York this morning, U.S. Ambassador to the UN, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, lashed out at Russia for its latest move.
This is really another act of cruelty. According to the World Food Program, more than 345 million people are suffering from high levels of food insecurity. And we know without a shadow of doubt that Russia's brutal war against Ukraine has pushed millions and millions more people to the brink, especially in the Middle East and Africa. That's what made the Black Sea Grain Initiative, brokered by the UN and Turkey, such a beacon of hope.
Thomas Greenfield went on to say that Russia has thrown all this progress and all of this hope to the wind. And among those who will suffer the hardest are the children in the Horn of Africa who are severely malnourished. To find out more about how this decision will impact Africa in the near term, I spoke this past hour to Harry Verhoeven, international economist at Columbia University and senior research scholar at the Center on Global Energy Policy.
Well, it's a complex question, Carol, because as you know, some of the figures and some of the actual flows to do with the grain deal are heavily disputed. Russia itself argues that actually this grain deal was not nearly as advantageous to countries in Africa and the Middle East suffering from food insecurity, and argues, of course, that a significant amount, perhaps even more than half of this amount, was actually flowing to developed countries, to countries in Europe and elsewhere, and that the effects on global food prices, and particularly food prices within African and Middle East countries, were mixed at best.
Is that statement true, what you just said?
Yes and no. I mean, it's certainly true that there's a number of local and regional drivers of food prices, for example, in places like Egypt or Ethiopia, where I'm at the moment, or in Kenya, that arguably have a bigger impact than whether this food is actually forthcoming from Ukraine, yes or no. So, for example, the plummeting value of the currency, which has partly to do also with the indebtedness of some of these African countries, is arguably a bigger factor at this moment in time than the flow of food grains from Ukraine. Now, this is not to say, of course, that the fact that Ukraine has been able to make available millions of tons of food did not have a positive effect. I mean, it is true, for example, that in the last couple of months, food prices at a global level have come down. And at least part of that explanation for that is the greater availability of grains coming from Ukraine. So, you know, even if the effects are indirect, they're still welcome from the perspective, I think, of many developing countries that are indeed facing these pressures. Even if, as I said, there are other determinants of this to do with the value of currency, the distortion in local markets, security dynamics, of course, in many of these countries, including a place like Sudan, for example, or Ethiopia or Somalia. So it's a complex story, and Russia's decision is not going to help, even if it is true that it would have been important to revise some of that deal to better target it towards developing countries and making sure that some of these grains were indeed not going to Spain or to Italy or other Western countries instead of the countries where really it ought to be heading.
With this severe drought here in the United States, for at least a large part of the country, the grain harvest is also way down, the lowest it's been in decades, especially in Kansas and Nebraska, two big wheat producers here. How much will that play a role in affecting the price of grain and food commodities being shipped to Africa?
I think significant. I mean, the heat wave we're seeing across the Northern Hemisphere, right, in the United States, in Europe, also key parts of Asia, don't forget, which are also very important for global food prices. are all going to have effects in the next 6 to 9 months, as is, of course, the growing onset of El Nino, again, particularly on I'm thinking here of the Horn of Africa and Southern Africa, where we already have chronic food deficits. And this is really unlikely to help local food production, which, again, as I said, has already been disrupted by political conflicts, by a number of, I think, fairly bad economic policies in a number of these countries. So, yeah, we're really looking at another set of shocks on the back, of course, of what happened with COVID, on the back, indeed, of these kind of protracted climatic changes, which are not helping.
That's Harry Verhoeven, senior research scholar at the Center on Global Energy Policy. He was speaking to me this past hour from Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. Africa is facing a tough year, from conflict in Sudan and the Sahel to droughts, floods, and other extreme weather events. But in a recent interview with VOA, the head of the African Development Bank, Akinwumi Adesina, is focusing on the continent's promise and how to better harness its rich environmental and human capital. Lisa Bryant has more for VOA from Paris.
African Development Bank President Akinwumi Adesina is looking at Africa's bottom line, but not the one used by number crunchers that looks at the value of a country's goods and services.
The way in which we measure wealth may in fact have driven many of these nature-rich countries into a higher level of debt and poverty traps.
Instead, he's pushing for another accounting method, looking at the massive natural wealth of African countries like those in the forest-rich Congo Basin, which helps absorb climate emissions, among other positive nature-based solutions.
Gabon, DRC, Congo, Equatorial Guinea, Angola. If you look at all of these countries that are in the Congo Basin area in particular, rich biodiversity, carbon sink, the largest carbon sink in the world. They get nothing for that. I've been pushing now that we need to revalue the wealth of the countries based on their natural capital.
Adesina spoke with VOA after a recent Paris summit intended to raise and rethink financing so poorer nations can tackle development and climate change. While activists say more must be done, observers say it delivered some concrete results, including a deal to restructure Zambia's $6.3 billion debt, $4 billion of which is owed to China.
I think that is good progress. It's slow, painful progress. I think we should be much faster. Creditors, time doesn't matter really so much for them, but the debtor countries can't. They need solutions now.
The West accuses China especially of pushing African countries into so-called debt traps for political or economic gain, something Beijing denies. Adesina didn't comment on that, but said China, which holds 14% of Africa's debt, must be part of other future debt solutions.
They are open to participating in collectively solving this problem for other countries. I will expect that they will have to do that anyway, given the amount of exposure that those countries have to them.
Rich nations in Paris also agreed to move $100 billion held by the International Monetary Fund into a climate and poverty fund for low-income countries. Adesina and others have been pushing for the money, part of so-called special drawing rights, or SDRs, to be channeled through the African Development Bank and similar multilateral development banks.
Every dollar of SDR that comes to us becomes, it's leveraged 3 to 4 times. So the leverage factor is very, very important. And the SDR donors lose nothing. And it comes at zero cost because we actually pay an interest rate for it.
Adesina also says natural resource-backed loans that tap Africa's rich trove of oil, gas, and minerals should be off the table completely. He calls them toxic, non-transparent debts that mortgage the future of African nations. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Tunisia and the European Union have signed a strategic partnership that includes combating human traffickers and tightening borders to reduce the flow of migrants leaving the North African nation for Europe. The deal signed yesterday in Tunis follows weeks of talks. Europe pledged $1.12 billion in aid to Tunisia to help its battered economy rescue state finances and deal with the migration crisis. Most funds are contingent on economic reforms. European Commission Chief Ursula von der Leyen said the bloc will allocate $112 million to Tunisia to combat illegal migration. The deal also promotes macroeconomic stability, trade and investment, green energy transition, and legal immigration. Thousands of undocumented African migrants have flocked to Tunisia in recent months, hoping to head for Europe in traffickers' boats. That has created an unprecedented migration crisis for Tunisia. You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. For more information on these and other stories from the continent, head on over to voaafrica.com. There you will find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. Rights activists and opposition groups in Zimbabwe say President Emmerson Mnangagwa's signing into law a so-called patriotic bill is a grave attack on fundamental freedoms and rights. The new law authorizes harsh penalties, including the death penalty, for anyone found guilty of, quote, willfully damaging the sovereignty and national interest of Zimbabwe, end quote. Columbus Mavunga reports from the capital, Harare.
Zimbabwe's main opposition party and human rights are calling on President Emmerson Mnangagwa to repeal the law he signed into law last Friday. Fadzai Mahere is the spokeswoman of the Citizens Coalition for Change.
We condemn the signing into law of the unconstitutional patriotic bill, which will criminalize free speech and freedom of association, which are protected under our constitution. The introduction of this repressive legislation confirms beyond any doubt that Mr. Mnangagwa is worse than Robert Mugabe, and Zimbabwe has become a full-blown dictatorship and an outpost of tyranny. It now behoves all citizens to ensure that we vote decisively for change on the 23rd of August.
My record on Zimbabweans to, as she put it, vote decisively for change in the August 23rd general election. Obed Masaraure is the spokesman for another rights group, the Crisis Coalition of Zimbabwe. He says the new law is vague in its definition of offences.
Some of the penalties proposed by the law for deliberately injuring the sovereignty and national interest of Zimbabwe, such as the death penalty, long imprisonment, loss of citizenship, and banning of persons from electoral participation for 5 years, are too harsh and inappropriate for vaguely defined offenses. The provision of the death penalty means that the new law violates the constitution, which only allows for the death penalty in cases of murder in aggravating circumstances. We firmly oppose the death penalty without exceptions. We are completely against the death penalty and we condemn it unreservedly.
Amnesty International said the new law is evidence that Zimbabwean authorities are bent on closing civic space as well as suppressing any form of dissent. But Lutendo Matinyarare, chairman of the pro-government Zimbabwe anti-sanctions movement, has a different view.
I'm over the moon because of the fact that the president has finally signed the criminal law amendment. I'm happy because I was one of the people that proposed it as the patriotic bill. And we are happy to see that we're beginning to get laws that punish people that go and advocate for sanctions, people that call for sanctions, people that call for the invasion of the country and destabilization of the country. I believe that this is a very good move. It puts us in step with other nations across the world that have similar laws. Let's hope it deters people and unites Zimbabweans to not sabotage their own country.
President Mnangagwa and the ruling ZANU-PF party have pushed for years for an end to Western sanctions against Zimbabwean leaders. The sanctions were imposed during the rule of the late Robert Mugabe for human rights violations and alleged election rigging. President Mnangagwa has not commented on the law known as the Criminal Law Codification and Reform Amendment Act he signed into law last week. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
South Africa is set to host the BRICS summit next month, but it is not clear which leaders will be attending or if the venue will change. Last week, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa said the meeting will be held in person, prompting questions about how the country would deal with the arrest warrant from the International Criminal Court for Russian President Vladimir Putin on war crimes charges. In the second and final part of our interview, Ambassador J. Peter Pham, a distinguished fellow at the Atlantic Council, describes to me the background of the BRICS relationship.
The term BRICS itself is relatively new. It was coined actually by an American banker to describe emerging economies which collectively would influence the 21st century. Brazil, China, Russia, India, South Africa. But the common interests of that group, there are some, but there are also divergences. Two of the BRICS countries are regularly at loggerheads and in conflict, China and India. So there are similarities, but there are also differences. And the question is really, do they have enough coherence to stick together as a group, or are there significant enough differences that as a collective, it's relatively meaningless, except as a club of people who aren't in other clubs.
Well, yeah. I mean, isn't it kind of a counteroffensive to NATO and other, you know, Western aligned groups?
Well, that's where the BRICS break up. Certainly, South Africa, China, and Russia engage in military exercises together. Most recently, unfortunately, on the anniversary of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. But India was not part of that, and Brazil stayed out of it. And as I mentioned earlier, India and China are regularly in conflict on their own borders. So there are differences among them. And so at the end of the day, the cohesiveness of the entire entity is questionable, although certain subsets, certainly the ties between China and Russia are very, very strong. And South Africa seems to be wanting to align itself with that.
Just one last question, and it's not really about BRICS, but as you know, recently a delegation from Africa led by the South African president tried to be the peacemakers with Ukraine and Russia and visited with both leaders on their turf. What, if anything, came of that?
In many respects, that visit, which was led by the really pushed by the South Africans, probably was one that they probably would have been better off not having. Not only was it shambolic, the plane accompanying the president, Ramaphosa, was stopped in Poland and not allowed to go on because of the number of military personnel and weapons on board. You had the president's spokesman denying that there were Russian attacks on Kyiv, although everyone else heard them at the time. So in many respects, it rather than being even-handed and playing peacemakers, it provided a very transparent fig leaf to damage control that South Africa was trying to do in the wake of the Lady R affair and other instances where it seemed to be less than neutral.
That's Ambassador J. Peter Pham, a distinguished fellow at the Atlantic Council and author of several articles on African affairs. He was speaking with me here in Washington. World number 6, Ans Jabeur, lost in the Wimbledon women's final Saturday, beaten by unseeded Marka Vondroucova of the Czech Republic. A year ago, Jabeur also lost in the Wimbledon finals, and she lost last year in the finals at the U.S. Open. After the match, a tearful Jabeur said she thought it was the most painful loss of her career, but she promised to come back and win at Wimbledon. At home in Tunisia, where Jabeur is known as the Minister of Happiness, her fans were disappointed. This man says they would have liked to have seen a historic achievement by putting Tunis among Wimbledon champions. It wasn't meant to be. Still, he says, Jabeur made history by playing in the Wimbledon final twice. Younger fans see her as a role model. 10-year-old Emma Bartagesa, playing at the Tunis Tennis Club, is among them. Emma says when she sees Ans, she dreams of becoming better than her or just like her and reaching the Grand Slam final. Jabeur was hoping to become the first African and Arab woman to win at Wimbledon. Sierra Leone is one of the world's poorest countries, but it's changing the way education is viewed. Since 2018, the government has promised free education for all children from pre-primary all the way through secondary school. However, there are still problems as the country recovers from an Ebola outbreak that began in 2014 and an 11-year-long civil war. Sierra Leone now spends more than 20% of its national budget on teacher salaries, revamping schools, and other costs to ensure free public education. Despite that investment, there are still challenges. Some Sierra Leonean children say teachers still beat them with canes if they do not pay school fees. Minister of Education David Moinina Senge is aware of the beatings.
I think it's sad because we have lots of amazing policies on inclusion, banning corporal punishment, in addition to the free quality school education, that doesn't get implemented well by everybody.
Senge says the government has taken steps to reduce corporal punishment.
We've made what we call access so close to the people by having about 300 school quality assurance officers. That's not enough, but those are humans who go to visit schools to find out. We also have a toll-free line where people can call to tell us what the problems are.
New York Times reporter Lucy King says she and her colleague Nicholas Kristof visited Sierra Leone recently because many African countries talk about improving their education system, but Sierra Leone is doing something about it.
The policy sounded great and is very promising and has improved enrollment by 50%, but the key challenge they're finding and the challenge that lots of other countries are finding is that it's really hard to improve quality of education. You can get kids into school, but you can't necessarily improve the quality of what they're learning.
King says Sierra Leone instituted free public education for all children, but later realized it did not have the money to pay its teachers. She says that means teachers are finding ways to earn a living, such as demanding school fees from students. While acknowledging that problems exist, Senge thinks he's making headway and notes changes do not happen overnight.
I think to change society, people have to begin to see the impact. And quickly, we're beginning to see that many more kids are passing their exams, many more kids are going across the university and transitioning into higher education and work. This will only mean many more people are going to want to send their kids to school.
King says the best thing Sierra Leone has going for it is the partnership between Senge and President Julius Maada Bio in pushing forward their education goals.
The average age of a Sierra Leonean, I believe, is 19. And so they see that they have this huge asset of young human capital that they should harness. And so I think they can make even more progress if they continue to go in the direction they're going in.
Even so, the problems remain daunting in a country the United Nations Development Program ranked at 181st out of 195 countries in 2021. And that wraps it up for this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent, 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Nikki Peters, and our engineer, Cornelius Tenner, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station. Say,